Today we're having an opportunity to have a Q&A session with Sandra Lim, the winner of this year's Levis Reading Prize. So, welcome, Sandra.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the award.
Thank you.
Sandra, often your poems begin with a provocative statement. They'll start with something that almost sounds like a philosophical statement or even a challenge. So, for example, the poem Certainty, there's two certainties in your poem. Well, the one that begins, "Perhaps you can tell children that the world is always a more beautiful place than you can suppose, and then you release them into their future, the black row of trees in the distance." So I'm interested in is how you move from that one perspective, that one strategy of communication, and then almost always you'll zoom in on an image as if that resolves into that. And I like that movement in your poetry. And I wondered if you would comment on that strategy.
Okay. I hope I can. Thank you for the question. It's interesting that you asked that because one of the difficulties of maybe writing the poems that became this book, a struggle that I had early on was with finding the right form for the different poems. So sort of the shadow behind this particular collection, there's another, I guess, manuscript that I kind of threw away in 2010 or so. And it really, it was because I couldn't find the line or the form for the poems. So some of those sort of longer lined and stopped poems, like a lot of the world poems or certainty, came from this impulse to try to say a thing clearly. Maybe that's where some of the philosophical statements came. And it wasn't as if I thought, I want to say something about the subject matter X clearly. It was just that I felt frustrated and wanted to be able to say something with some kind of confidence or boldness. And I think the form came first in a way, and within that form I was able to somewhat confidently make a statement. And then the move into the image, I felt like the image could then be another form of inquiry. So sort of backing up in a way these sometimes maybe audacious statements or things that I was testing out in the poem. But of course, I wish I had known that sometimes when sitting down to write some of these. It was a lot of trial and error.
You have an interest in the book in forms as well. Some of them, I think, invented forms. At least there's one poem, I'm trying to remember which one it is, that it uses repetition really strikingly. Go ahead, David.
I wonder if you're thinking about Jebel Sombre,
which
is kind of a palindrome poem.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to write... I don't normally write in very fixed forms, like, even though I guess it's unfair, I make my students do a Sestina or a Villanelle, but something about that particular poem, and it's a sort of love poem, the repetitions seemed important. I wanted to see if the line, as with so many palindromes, said the second time around, it would take on a different valence. So that was fun to write. And it also brought me back to looking at other poems written in that form. So it was sort of fun to revisit other works written in that form. But it's not a usual move for me, I guess.
You know, one of the subjects we had some discussion about, particularly when we were talking about it in the undergraduate workshop, is in terms of the poems in the long lines, there's a lot of debate as to whether we were to be considering them as prose poems or as poems in long lines.
Yeah.
And some of them do carry over to the second line and are right margin adjusted, which typographically speaking, that suggests that they should be read as prose.
Right.
And so there was a real chicken or the egg debate going on about how the line was conceived in the book. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I think that was why I had a lot of anxiety too, because I did at one point think, I think the way I come down on it now is they are lines of poetry and they're poem, but if I could have it in both ways, because I don't think of them as prose poems. I think because of this stanza breaks, mm-hmm. Even if you could think of it as a very airy prose poem in a certain sense. But one of the ways in which it came back was when the book was in proofs. They had, in the typesetting, I was so used to seeing the poems in my Word document. So they cut off always at the same place, even if they wrapped just because of the right mm-hmm. justified margin. But then there was this debate about whether where it broke off, if they were going to be indented or how it was going to look. And so it kind of like brought up the question of it all again. But I think the way that I hope that they are read or intended to be read is I do have an investment in that kind of the prose-like rhythm of that long line. Because I think that whatever I'm saying in each poem, that long line really helped me to be able to say it, I guess, is how I'm going to articulate it now. But it's something that it's hard now that I'm trying to write new poems. I think it was very specific to that moment or this particular collection. Now if I try to write in that form, it feels, well, I either feel a little bit mannered about it or... And I'm thrown into that question again. Well, am I really looking for a prose poem here or for a poem in lines, but it's a kind of prose-like line.
Earlier we were talking about Homage to Mistress Bradstreet and how you had mentioned that you wanted to participate in a conversation that Berryman was having with her. And the first poem has the line, "So let me consider from here, from inside the head of my demon," and which summons also, you know, like Socrates talking about like his demon that guided him about what he should do, kind of a conscience or a guiding spirit, a guardian. I was wondering if you could talk about, in this poem, but in other poems too, how you work with that guiding voice that inside the head of, you know, my demon.
That's funny, because one of the ways, and I haven't thought about it until now, until your question, is when I was sitting down to write, well, that poem in particular, but any other poems, there's such a sense now in writing poetry, or I guess it's been like this for a long time, where that sense of encountering something for the first time and writing about it freshly without a sense of immediately the thought after of thinking, well, this has been said before, this has been thought before, that mediation is always so present. So in a funny way, I thought when writing that poem, not that that was the main subject necessarily, but there, because the conversation was so peopled already with mm-hmm. Berryman and Bradstreet and all the other people that have kind of weighed in or been in that, that it was almost easy, or sort of an easy way to kind of admit that or acknowledge that mediation and make something of it, I guess, make something poetically of it. I don't know if that makes sense exactly, but I think that's there in the poem and in other poems too.
I think you had mentioned earlier that you felt as if you come late to the poetry party in your life, as opposed to writing a poem when you were 6 or 7 years
right.
old. So I wonder if you could kind of talk about how that happened. I might say you got your PhD before ever going to get your MFA, so
right.
obviously you were on one track to do kind of the study of literature to
yeah.
all of a sudden creating it. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that path.
Yeah. As I was saying, when I was younger, and I think as we probably all are, we're big readers and falling in love with reading, and I just thought I would be a fiction writer. That's mostly what I read. And high school, too, most of what I was exposed to, probably still the same way. People are exposed to more prose, fiction. And when I teach, too, my students are still more, in my intro class, we do fiction, nonfiction, poetry. And everyone sort of gets a little uncomfortable when we do the poetry section, because it seems somehow as harder or more difficult. So that was probably all there for me too. But I took a reading and writing poetry class in college kind of by accident, because it fit in with my schedule. And I just really was so excited. I mean, of course, I had been exposed to poetry before, but maybe not a lot of modern poetry. And later, actually, when I went to get my MFA. I know so many people that can do both or can do so many different genres, but I remember asking a friend of mine, how do you sit down and write a story? That's, you know, but a poem I feel comfortable somehow. So there's, and he's like, how do you sit down and write a poem? You know, can you tell me? How do you do that? So there was in a way in which I feel like you feel more comfortable, you feel chosen, or the genre chooses you somehow. Again, aside from the people that can do everything really well. But yeah, initially I was very shy about thinking, oh, I'm going to be a writer, I'm going to be a poet. So, and I wanted to read more in both poetry, fiction, just to get to know American and British literature. But towards the end of my PhD, I felt like I wasn't naturally a very good critic. And I was always writing poetry on the side. And in a way, it was actually very freeing, because if you're doing something on the side, I'm just doing it on the side. It's not my main thing. So, but it was important, I think, to go get my MFA after, because then to declare, okay, I'm going to be responsible to my imagination or to this investment, it was good for me to do it kind of in that order, because I felt like I had some time to do a lot of reading, do a lot of thinking. I think if I had gone maybe right after my undergraduate time, I mean, I like to write, but I don't know if I really would have necessarily had anything to say. So, and I'm a very slow writer too, so I probably needed those 8 years. And then it was just sheer fun to be able to be in a place where people took writing so seriously, and just to be able to do that all the time, basically. So I like to write in coffee shops. Being at like a great coffee shop, and you would see people really, really passionate. You could see people get into arguments at bars about poems and poets. And so that was so new and exciting to me. So it was great. And then I was able to field questions of people who were then thinking of doing their PhD, so I could tell them, maybe, maybe not, here's what my experience was.
When compiling your second book and writing it, was there any joys or frustrations that were new for the second book than the first one? Like anything that was wonderful or anything that just...
torture. Yes, a lot of frustration. I think because at least with one's first book, it's like your whole life, and then there's your book. Whether it's, you know, autobiographical or not. But then I remember talking with a friend, you know, I can see now there a lot with a lot of second books, there's a lot of project books, and I feel like I understand that impulse, because people, maybe not necessarily even being at a loss about what to write about, but there's a self-consciousness there. So there was that to deal with. Also, I really wanted to not sound like or not work in the same, I guess, forms or voices as I was working with in my first book. So that was a very conscious choice or decision, which became frustrating too, because then it was a matter of really just exploring. And that's why I think the manuscript that I wrote, or that I finished in 2010, it just really didn't, it was very inert, because I think it was too consciously, a project. I couldn't even tell you exactly what the project was now. So it was, then I had to go poem by poem, and then, you know, sometimes I'd think, well, why am I writing a poem about this, you know, frontier minister? I don't want to write a whole poem, a book of poems about that necessarily. And then another one would be, oh, a family poem is coming up. But I just trusted that I'll just go poem by poem, and then see if it comes together as a collection.
Sandra, a lot of your poems, especially in the wilderness, often commence with a statement, mm-hmm. sometimes a really disarming statement that is, you know, provocative. It's such a poetry workshop cliche, particularly among undergraduates, to, you know, do the pound thing and tread in fear of abstraction. How did it feel in composing the book to be so reliant on statement and having it this received piety among poets that, you know, you're supposed to not really use them too much?
Right. Yes. I mean, it was very scary, and probably why it was such a struggle, actually, to write some of the poems in the book. But in some ways, I never felt as if I was that good at writing images, actually, writing description. Like, I would look at Elizabeth Bishop and I'm like, how does she do that? That was, it wasn't, it didn't come very easily to me. So in some ways, I think it was just having to trust, again, poem by poem. If I thought too much, wait, here's another poem that starts with a kind of alarming or provocative statement, then I might have shied away. But just going poem by poem helped a little bit with that. And then after a while, I thought, okay, well, this is me, or this is how I'm writing, so I'm just going to have to follow it. And because of this impulse of wanting to sort of say something clearly, because I was getting tired of writing my own poems where I thought, this is kind of veering now into like soft focus surrealism or something. What am I doing here? What am I saying? Can I just be there kind of nakedly with a statement and see what I could make out of that? So that was kind of the challenge of writing some of the poems.
I'm kind of interested, a few of the poems I read, to me, the feeling sense I get, I'm not a poet, I'm a fiction, but is you step out and you address the poetry, or in a few you address art, which is like addressing image. And I wonder if there was an edge that you sometimes played where you felt like, okay, maybe I'm stepping too far out of the poem. How do I pull it back? I found that very interesting. I really like that idea that, I guess you could call it meta, but that idea of addressing what you do and what you are in a poem that's really about something else, but using that also as image in a layer. But it feels very tempting to then step out into sort of the autobiographical realm and out of the poem itself. And I'm wondering if you struggled with that, or how you managed to do that so successfully.
Thank you. It's such careful reading. I think it was frustrating in a lot of ways. That was the management, the way I see it, maybe if I'm understanding correctly, it was a managing of tone in a way. And so much for me, I feel like, especially these days, as I try to write new poems, it really starts with like sniffing out a tone of some sort, and then how I'm following that in order to write the poem. So I think some of those moves where I'm stepping out and being more meta, as you say, I guess I would say I managed it by kind of testing the tone of the poem. I think so. It's hard to know how conscious sometimes these moves are, right? Because it sounds okay, or it sounds right, or it sounds not okay. It sounds mannered, which is always, or it's inert all of a sudden because I've done that too much. So to peel away.
Did you have a sense occasionally when you were working on it that, I don't know, it's almost reading it, I feel like I can feel that moving out of that space a little bit, just to the periphery, and I wonder as the author if you almost felt like you needed to be drawn back in. It really has this kinetic sense to it when I read that. I recently tried to do this, and that's why my curiosity is heightened by this in creative nonfiction, but that sense of being pulled away and then being pulled back in. And I'm just curious if that was a feeling sense in the creation process, or if that's just a lucky happenstance in my reading of it or something. I don't know.
I'm sure some of it was luck, but I'm not sure if this is exactly in those moments if this is happening. But sometimes I wonder if when you're writing fiction or if you're writing a poem, there are moments where I'm like, there I am doing that again. You know, like, there's my tick. So then that's easy to just kind of throw out, even if sometimes I'm really in love with the line or something, but it just doesn't quite go there because that's just my, I guess I'll call it a tick. There I am doing that again, and then I think I'd be brave enough to throw that out and start over. So maybe there's a little bit of that of going out too far and coming back in.
Thank you.
Your book frequently alludes to or directly takes up the subject of seasons. And the season that's dominant, at least in my reading of it, is spring.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the long poem, obviously, Vera Novum, early spring, takes that up and then also deals with a certain almost inherent irony, I think, that's present for all of us now, which is that you're primarily an urban person, but you're referring to the Georgics of Virgil, and you're making allusions to a pastoral tradition past in poetry. And I found it interesting that what you seem to reach for as a counterpoint to any kind of antique orientation in a poem like that
mm-hmm.
was allusions to magic or to magic tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really found that part in Vera Novum where you talk about this time of year challenges you like a little magician fanning the day's cards brusquely in your face. Pick a card, any card. And that also seemed to express a kind of taunting that these seasons do to a person in our time. Almost like it draws you out into this, mythic territory, and then it's like, but I'm not really living in there. So I was wondering if you would comment a little bit about how you entered into those poems, what you found yourself discovering as you wrote them.
I'm glad you said spring, too, because it is such a wintry book in other ways. And so people are like, winter, I hope your next book is about spring. And I'm like, it is about spring and my fraught relationship with spring. Some of it is, even though some of the poems began before I moved to the Northeast, because I'm originally from California and I was not used to such well-defined, harsh seasons. But I definitely, the drama of the seasons was so beguiling or enchanting to me. Even last winter, when sometimes we felt like we were being buried alive under all that snow. But it's also not a bad atmosphere in which to do some writing. But I felt very nervous about description and image and not feeling like I'm naturally a nature poet or anything like that. And if anything, I think of myself as more of having an urban sensibility. But that particular poem, I was very taken with, I forget the number of the canto, but Pound, where there's the line, Vera Novum, and this makes the spring, or something like that. And it's the seasons. I mean, I think in that particular canto, I wish I could remember the number, he's talking about kind of transmutation and magic on a deep level, and sexuality and seasons. So that was the sort of the inspiration for that. And elsewhere in the book too, there's something so tricky and so taunting, as you say, about, for me, spring especially, because, and also being in the Northeast, you think winter is over and spring is coming, and then no, it's snatched away from you very suddenly. And it's supposedly the time of rebirth, but all I can see sometimes is just examples of death or things dying. In a way, it's more vivid at that time. And, depression in spring, all those things, came to the fore. So I think it was just a rich ground for me to play around in.
Well, I found it humorous and really enjoyable, too, that you figured in the poem, spring acts like a kind of a bad boyfriend. And then that's addressed at the very end of the poem. It says, spring, which says it's never been unfaithful, mixing insult and provocation.
Yeah, sort of come closer, go away, in the same move.
That's an interesting line, too, because it brings up another question I wanted to ask you, because that line sounds almost like this, giving the middle finger to the beginning of the wasteland, reaching memory and desire.
Mm-hmm.
And there are myriad literary references and literary debts that you pay in the poems that, and it's really refreshing because you're always trying to find a way to renegotiate and refresh the tradition. And so I was just wondering who among the people in the tradition and your contemporaries you feel are your touchstones, the people you come back to and draw your inspiration from.
Well, I love T.S. Eliot. So he's there. Although it's funny because whenever I teach, say something like The Wasteland, it's not, at least my students, they haven't been that excited. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Or the Fragmentation and quotes, they're just like, it's kind of old hat or whatever. Yeah. But, and I also very much love Four Quartets. So I love T.S. Eliot. I love Rilke, although I have never read him in German, only in translation. Some of the older poets, what I did my dissertation on when I was in graduate school was the New York School of Poets, actually. So Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery, Schuyler, so the first generation, and their negotiations with the visual and performing arts. And I think of those three, people are always like, oh, I can sort of hear O'Hara, but I was really taken with Schuyler at the time. So, and now I think that seems more apparent. But in terms of older poets that I sort of return to, I like the modernists, like Eliot, Stevens, I return to. I've been getting a little bit more into Marianne Moore. She wasn't ever a huge favorite of mine in the beginning, lately. And then I love American mid-50s poets, so the New York School, but also Plath, Berryman, you know. And part of it is the poems themselves, of course, but that kind of fire and energy and, I don't know, it's very different, I feel like, from my sensibility, but that announcement of ambition. And it just, you know, it seemed like an exciting time. So, and that comes off in their books, so... Those are some of the people I guess I return to.
Yeah, Pound himself wrote a poem called Barum Novum.
Yes.
And I was trying to make parallels between that. I'm teaching a modernist class right now, and so I'm very conscious. I know David has been teaching that too lately. I'm very conscious of hearing those echoes in your work. That's really interesting. Another thing that you take up frequently in the allusions that you involve yourself with are they're not exactly, in fact they're definitely not ekphrastic poems, but you allude to a visual artist. The very first poem in the book alludes to Rembrandt. But what's interesting to me, and I think this is one of the things, a number of things that drew me to your book, is that your poems are not ekphrastic in any traditional way. There's almost like you're doing battle or responding to the visual artist that you whose work you take up and take an interest in.
Yeah. I think it's partly, too, I love looking at visual art and from all sorts of periods. I feel also very, like, with writing, obviously, I write, and I feel like sometimes I even have some musical ability, but no visual ability. So partly it's that fascination with the thing that you're very bad at, in a way. But I also love looking at paintings or visual art. There's something so, the material is so apparent. That sounds like such an obvious thing to say. But I think sometimes with poems, that's why I'm drawn to writing about them. Sometimes like the fact of making art seems so on the surface or so present or foregrounded in the work, in the visual artwork in some way. So I think that's a lot of the fascination with it. And from all periods, because there's a poem later in the book where I just steal two lines from a contemporary artist, I think he passed away now, but where he would do these sculptures with like yarn and light and things like that. So I liked having that kind of modern counterpoint to starting out with somebody like Rembrandt. I was also interested in self-portraits too, so I love that kind of weird disconnect of a person doing, a visual artist doing a self-portraiture, but the many kind of removes that happen there. And maybe in some ways it's fascinating to me as a writer.
How do you know when a poem's finished?
It feels right.
Feels right.
I think I'm just going to say, yeah, it feels right. It feels done. But I let them sit around for a while. I think some of them, I'm just like, yeah, that's it. But I let them sit for a while because I have to come back and see if it still feels done.
Sticking with the feely questions, how did you come to understand a lot of the poems that are compiled in this collection as a collection?
It was a much fatter book, I guess, at first. And first, I think I did what a lot of people do. I just grouped things that seemed to go together. But, yeah, I mean, I guess this is in line with the feely question part of it. Certain strands seem to connect and belong, so that I thought, oh, yeah, I can put this poem about Puritans and this larger poem about Puritans alongside these other poems, and there's a kind of conversation or resonances that I can see happening. But I was very, I also didn't want it to be too, I didn't want it to be heavy-handed either and be like, this is the theme of this book and therefore it will be titled this. And even the cover, I was very nervous that I wouldn't have any say, and they were very nice in allowing me to give suggestions, but I was just like, I know it's called The Wilderness, but please, no trees on the cover. You know, I wanted a kind of contrast, decidedly so. So,
I'd like to ask you if you would be willing to elaborate on Unfleur. Am I saying that right?
Mm-hmm.
If you'd be willing to elaborate on it, especially what is death but reason in flawless submission to itself.
Can I get take out the Oh, this is a spring poem. I thought you were going to ask me about the title, because I actually, at first I thought, you know how sometimes words come to you and you're like, how did I know that word? Is it a real word? Of course, right? I'm sure it happens all the time. And I'm actually not sure that this one is actually, at first I thought, well, fleur, French, you know. I'm sure I've seen it or heard it somewhere, but I don't think it's an actual French word in and of itself. But it really, the poem came from the title. And not wanting to kind of spell out the poem, I wanted to sort of explain the title. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Can I say that without actually spelling out the rest mm-hmm. of the poem? And there was a change that I made, actually, in that stanza, what is death but reason and flawless submission to itself? I think first I had something much more dramatic, like what is death but reason cutting its own throat or something like that. And I thought, no, that's too much. That's too dramatic. So it became that. If that's okay, if I can say that much.
One of the things that you take up in your book, in addition, is, I suppose this is not surprising, but there are a number of subjects that are spiritual or maybe even religious in mm-hmm. nature. Garden Quarrel, of course, takes up the story of Adam and Eve and reconfigures it and examines it, interrogates it. And then it does so with, oftentimes I think, it seems to me that when you are most attracted to a subject, you then fight with it.
Mm.
and so you have, I was always a religious bitch, all prolepsis and superstition. You know, a kind of ironic or even self-examining voice comes in. And mm-hmm. The ending of the poem about the moral impunity of the apple, I ease it from its branch so that it's snake low. She eats it carefully, inspecting the potential of the snake with each bite. And so there's quite a bit of humor in that poem, too. I'm observing that, but I wonder how you felt in composing it. Or, yeah.
It's funny, because when I wrote the poem, a friend of mine who looked at the manuscript said, oh, there's your Adam and Eve poem. Usually that happens in first books. And I said, really? Again, I'm belated. I didn't know that everyone had an Adam and Eve poem, so this was news to me. And my friend's very smart and a voracious reader, so I believe her. But there were many reasons, I'm sure there are many reasons why people write their poems about Adam and Eve or rewrite that story. It was a moment for me in those parts to sort of be humorous. I never wanted to be just plainly ironic about spirituality or religion. That's not how I feel. But there is in a way in which I was trying to, I mean, always trying to be sincere, but look at it with a little bit of a distance from a distance, a little bit of nuance. So I think in the different sections, I was curious. At first, it was conceived of as I would do it from their different perspectives, perspective of the snake, the perspective of Eve, the perspective of Adam, and it became a little bit different. But it's such a hallowed subject in some ways, and I thought there is, I think it's very funny in a way that these are our sort of touchstone stories or our spiritual stories. They're eating fruit, you know, it's just like, there's a lot of just inherent humor in it for me in some ways, and how they could have been feeling that they might have felt, again, self-conscious about this dramatic thing happening to them.
That "I was always a religious bitch" quote is that's from Billie Holiday.
Billie Holiday,
yeah.
Yes. Who I think is, you know, you may not think of her as, well, I think of her as very spiritual. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, wanting to haul in that sense or that tone. It's also very moving to me because, again, you don't think of her first as a very religious person, but then listening to her music, looking at her life, I just think all I can see is a great spiritual struggle in a way. So, but I love, yeah, that's exactly where the line is from.
In your poem, Human Interest Story, that's one of the poems. There is, in many of your poems, there's a background reference to your coming from a family that comes from Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But in that poem, Human Interest Story, there's an expression of a certain kind of intense and even angry awareness of all that's implied in that. You talk about your father and his older brother having hanged himself, and you talk about the father saying, "No one can evict us from books," and that sense of being threatened that occurs in the book, and the references to trials and things like that. Could you talk a little bit about how that background has affected you as a writer, and maybe even, you don't have to allude to how it shows up in the poem, but if you want to, that's okay too.
You mean just the background of coming, being, I was born in Korea, but came over very early. I think it was 3 and a half, almost 4. So I was telling you the other night, I joke that I'm like 1.5 generation. And I think some of the poems that directly allude to my family background, I mean, it's not like I sat down and thought, oh, I'm going to write a poem about my uncle, who I didn't really know very well, but in our family, there were not even mythic stories, but he was, I mean, because he was a suicide, it was an intense topic, but my parents never spoke about it with any hushed tones or anything. But I always felt a weird, and he wasn't an artist, but a weird sort of kinship or something to him. So I knew, I think, somewhere in the back of my mind always that I would write something about him or something about maybe that time, which I don't know that much about. I'm sort of always on the fence about actually sitting there. I don't want to lose the stories, any family stories, like with a tape recorder with my parents. But I also, I think there's a part of me that doesn't want to write kind of a straight memoir or even straight narrative poems about them in that way. So to me, that particular story, even why I title it Human Interest Story, it's in and of itself, it's a curious story to me. And I think my feelings about how you use family history, about how you use things that are sort of senseless and unexplainable, and then how you tell stories anyway, those are really the things that are in the fore for me in that poem, and even in the other poem about like my mother and a grandmother and everything. I still haven't figured out in some ways, or I don't know if there it's supposed to be figure out how to use even the phrasing, how to use my background, right? Like, in a way, it's always there, even when I'm writing about Edward Taylor. It's always present in some ways. But it may not always be the subject matter out in front, which I think I want to hold on to that freedom. You know, because I've certainly had more with the first book. I've had, actually, people come up to me after reading saying, and that book had even less poems that were sort of about directly about family, you know, why don't you write about what they're, I think they're asking me for is a very legible story about being an immigrant or, you know, being Korean American, et cetera, kind of thing. And it was odd to me back then during the readings for the first book that people would ask this. Now it's less odd. I kind of understand the impulse, but I'm sort of defensive about being able to write about whatever I want, in a sense. And then having it naturally come up and not being too self-conscious about writing those things. And now there are people writing with fake Asian names as well, so things are coming all over a full circle.
That is something I wanted to ask you about, the courage to go forward with the subject matter that is important to the writer, but may or may not be important to readers, and seeing the talent obviously in the writing, but in the manuscript process maybe questioning my own aesthetic or what it is I want to write about, and hoping, you know, it's like throwing and seeing what sticks, and writing about the stuff that I want to write about and then hoping it's appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe, you know, in my own fear, my own self-doubt, hoping the writing is good enough that they'd appreciate the story. Or how do you go forward with that big question mark of, this is what I wanted to write about, and
yeah,
you're knowing that somebody may be like, no, and you know, but
like that gesture that
I mean,
make,
you know, like, it's like everybody else is writing about this.
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe I should be ending my lines with the word bone or teeth, or, you know, it's, how do I go in my own direction? Like, some of these poems, I had to read them so many times because it's so unique from what everybody else is doing. And I appreciate it. And all I kept thinking was the courage at first to, like, this is what I want to write about, and going with it. How, where did you get that?
Oh, thank you. That's so nice. Probably at the time of writing, I didn't think of it as very courageous, but some of it is, you are, I don't know if this is the right image, like I was going to say, backed into a corner. Like, that's what you can write about, right? Like, that's what you can do. So it didn't feel necessarily like, oh, I'm being very different and going forth. If anything, I think when we were talking earlier, I was like, am I really going to write a poem where I use John Berryman's actual title? Like, am I going to do that? But at least the great freedom before anyone sees it or takes it as a book is you can do whatever you want, right? And see what happens. There's also something about poetry, too. I know this is just from talking with friends who write fiction. Maybe because there isn't, like, some kind of big financial book deal behind it or something. I just feel there's a lot of, there's a lot more freedom, artistic freedom, initially, in a way, I guess. So you can experiment, you can do whatever you want. I love that about poetry, or about the particular gift economy that it's a part of. So I didn't necessarily feel, oh, I'm being so brave by writing about this. I mean, maybe the other side of that question is, well, will this find a readership, which anybody is afraid of, or wants a wider readership. But that, I think then you're writing to something else completely. So it, I don't feel like it enters into it that much. I mean, it's just always scary to sit down and be like, can I ever write another poem that's like halfway decent, right? Like, that happens every day. that's maybe the courage part. Like, why would anybody else keep sitting down to do this weird thing? Except that it's a joy, too, on the other hand. Like, this miserable joy, I don't know. Joyous misery.
Well, thank you. That's that last set of comments and questions really reveals that you've transcended any kind of narrow boundaries of identity politics, and that you're moving along something that's, I think, actually more profound. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.